WNYC is supported by the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first-ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting today, a retirement reality check.
I mean, yes, I'm in between pictures, as they say in Hollywood. But long ago, I realized as a so-called cult film director, not only did I need a plan B that was just as important to me as movie making, I needed a plan C, D, and E. But plan H for Hitchhike? I'm 66 years old, for Christ's sake.
John Waters on this program recently, between pictures, as he delicately put it, and looking for a plan B, plan C, and plan H, just a little less earnest than when Nelson Mandela retired in 2004.
I am turning 86 in a few weeks' time, and that is a longer life than most people are granted. I have the added blessing of being in very good health, at least according to my doctors. I am confident that nobody present here today will accuse me of selfishness if I ask to spend time while I'm still in good health with my family, my friends, and also with myself. When I told one of my advisors a few months ago that I wanted to retire, he growled at me, "You are retired." If that is really the case, then I should say, I now announce that I'm retiring from retirement.
I'm retiring from retirement. Too much work in regular retirement, raising the question of selfishness for wanting to stop working. Interesting. Nelson Mandela in 2004, and we heard John Waters in 2014. So what about you and when? Now, retirement as we know it is such a new idea in the history of the world that for this family meeting, we will trace the history of retirement. It runs in this country through Thomas Paine, through Abraham Lincoln, with a detour to Germany through Otto von Bismarck, back through American Express before we get to FDR and Social Security. And we will invite you to call in with some family meeting oral history, how your parents and grandparents did retirement, if at all, compared to you or how you hope to. You can start that going at 212-433-WNYC. We'll do some retirement geography, Boca or Brooklyn, if you can afford the choice, on your own or with your adult children. And we'll do a retirement reality check for listeners of any age with two personal finance experts. For example, how early do you need to start saving? Like an IRA versus paying down your student loans? Anyone? So let's talk history. With us now, Tom Jankowski, Associate Director of Research at the Institute on Gerontology at Wayne State University in Detroit. Tom, thanks very much for doing this. Hello from New York. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I'm pleased to be here.
I said Tom Paine through Abraham Lincoln, through Otto von Bismarck and American Express as a very early private sector innovator. Let's hit those posts. Tom Paine, founding father, wrote that pamphlet, Common Sense, about declaring independence from Britain. He also proposed a form of social insurance.
He did, and as well as publicly financed health insurance.
Something like Social Security at that time, or would they not have had that concept in an agrarian economy?
You know, Tom Paine, for his time, was a radical. And, you know, obviously, while he proposed this in the 18th century, you know, we didn't have a public pension system until the states started doing it in the early 20th century, and then the federal government in 1935 with the Social Security Act. But he was ahead of his time.
And we'll get to the states and some of how the courts struck down the early efforts, but as you say, didn't happen in Tom Paine's day. But let's flash forward to the Civil War, where the Union government offered recruits a pension plan. Did they use the word pension in the way we do today?
You know, I think they couched it more in terms of veteran benefits and sort of and as well as you know, widows pensions for the wives of veterans who were killed in the war.
And eligibility for that Civil War pension, if I've got my history right, expanded from only vets who were injured in the war to Civil War veterans in general and their immediate survivors. And I wonder if that was a historically important leap, you know, from a pension that a worker collects only if disabled because they couldn't work, to something you collect after a certain age or length of time, so for some of your later life you don't have to work.
You know, it was an important precedent. Before that, we had pensions for the merchant marine, but that was a really small portion of the population compared to the Civil War veterans.
And by the 1880s, I read 37% of the federal budget was going to the Civil War veterans or their survivors. Sounds like the debate we're having today. Maybe that was the first retirement budget buster.
I think it was. There was a lot of public action and protests and demonstrations to win those benefits. So they weren't given freely. They were fought for.
And I read a story about a historical fluke. Do you know this one? The last Civil War pensioner collected it until 2003.
I did not know that.
This is, according to a history article that I read, a woman named Janeway. She, in 1927, was 18 years old, and she married an 81-year-old Civil War veteran. He lived another few years, so she was eligible then as a survivor to continue to collect his Civil War veteran's pension. And she lived until a ripe old age in 2003. So there was one American collecting Civil War pension benefits till 2003. Isn't that a funny story?
That is a fascinating story.
Now,
it's very similar to the story of the first Social Security recipient who only paid in $22, I think, and got about $22,000 back in. She retired in 1940, and she lived until the 1970s.
Yes, but history forgets all those people who paid into the system and then died before they retired. So
exactly. And actuarially, that is necessary to support the people who live longer than expected.
Right. And it happens. It just doesn't make the news and the political speeches. So, folks, as we're doing this chronological history, let's do some oral history. Listeners who are retired, call in and describe the difference between your retirement and that of your parents or your grandparents, or go back as far as you can. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We're looking for some oral history from some of our older listeners. Or even some of our younger listeners, if you've researched your family past, if you know some of this, however far back, reach back as far in your personal, your family history as you can on the phones right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But mostly for those who are retired now, and we'll take calls from younger listeners on different questions later in this family meeting, but listeners who are retired, or anyone else who's done the research, call in and describe the difference between your retirement and that of your parents or your grandparents, or go back even further, go back as far as you can, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. A call-in oral history from some of you to reach back as far in history as you can on the phones right now, 212-433-WNYC. Describe the difference between your retirement and that of your parents or your grandparents. Did they even have the word? 212-433-9692. As we continue to discuss the chronological history of retirement in America with Tom Jankowski, Associate Director of Research at the Institute on Gerontology at Wayne State University in Detroit. Tom, we've had this question on Facebook for a few days and gotten some interesting responses. For example, Lauren wrote, "A cautionary tale is my sister's father-in-law, who had a good job but didn't save and now lives only on Social Security and his pension, basically in poverty due to his health issues." And then she writes, "I don't feel I can look to my parents or their friends for retirement models. Their income was steadier, their employment more continuous. My husband's and my income has been flat," college professor, "or decreasing freelance writer. We put the max allowed into IRAs, but I don't see how we're going to be able to save the amount recommended in order to live off the interest. We're in our early to mid-50s. So that's just one person's story where she sees her parents' retirement as more advantageous than her own right now or her prospects being in her early to mid-50s. How about for you? Compare your prospects or your retirement to that of your parents, your grandparents. Go back as far as you can. 212-433-9692. Tom, when did people start to use the word retirement like the American middle class uses it today? You know, like a time in old age to relax and play golf on an employer pension or on money that you saved?
I don't think that the concept or the word of retirement really became popular until around World War II, the 1940s. There was a concept of pensions before then, but pensions were usually intended for people who could no longer work, and if you could work, you were expected to continue to work. But the idea that you were expected to stop working and enjoy some leisure time at the end of your life is a relatively modern phenomenon.
You find the first private sector plan in 1875, offered by American Express. Have you looked at that particular history, and do you know what it was like, and what led a private sector company to offer it for a first time?
You know, to be honest with you, I'm not sure what led American Express to offer it, but I know that what and at the time, 1875, that was the only company that was offering private pensions.
Correct.
And even as late as the 1920s, only 5% of workers had a private pension. So it took off slowly. What really prompted the growth of private pensions was a change in the tax laws in 1926 that made pension trust funds tax exempt, and that gave private corporations and companies an incentive to create these pension funds.
Let's take a phone call with some oral history. John in Middlesex, you're on WNYC. Hi, John. John, you call. Hey, John. Good. You're calling in about your grandparents?
Yes. Actually, my great-great-grandfather fought for General Phil Sheridan in the Civil War, so he would have been eligible for one of those early pensions.
Did enough family knowledge get handed down to know if he actually received a Civil War veteran's pension?
Yes, and then both of my grandfathers, both my maternal and paternal grandfathers, worked for private industrial firms. Throughout the 20th century and throughout their lifetime, but throughout my lifetime, they were both retired and lived very comfortably on private pensions and were never union members. They were just treated very generously by their company.
Uh-huh. And how do you see that as different from your own prospects?
Okay. I have life insurance, but that's my only form of protection right now.
That's for when you're dead.
I'm very young yet. I don't have any retirement.
Okay, so you may want to tune into our reality check segment later in this family meeting when we'll talk to people like you about what you may need to be doing right now so that you can live like your parents, if not your grandparents or your great-great-grandparents, when you get there a few decades from now. Brenda in Parsippany, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brenda.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. So how far back in your family do you want to go?
Okay, I'm going to go back to my parents. My parents came from South Carolina as part of the Great Black Migration in the late 40s. In fact, they met in New Jersey. And when they retired, my mother worked basically as a domestic. And later on, she had some Social Security. And my father worked for a company. Then later on, he was self-employed as a plumber. So when they retired, they basically lived off Social Security. In fact, my father is still living. So their life completely different than my retirement.
Now,
I'm 66, and I retired from Verizon. I started at New Jersey Bell Atlantic, Verizon, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
I took a buyout in 2002, and I rolled over my pension into an IRA, and I also saved my money through my 401k. And I've had, fortunately, a very nice retirement on the fact that I am able to travel, I own my own home, and I have a very nice lifestyle.
That's great. Now, when you look back at your parents, they didn't work for the kind of company that could offer a pension. If one was a domestic and one was a self-employed plumber, then they had to either save on their own or just rely on Social Security. So they wound up without savings, really, in those jobs that they had?
I mean, because I have to say, we always just say my mother could work a dollar. She really, you know, she never overextended herself. So they had some money saved, but not that much. But they saved as much as they could, and they never lived beyond their means.
Thank you, Brenda. Thank you very much for checking in. So, Tom Jankowski, before we get to FDR and Social Security, which, you know, you can only imagine what would have become of Brenda's parents without Social Security. If one had worked as a domestic and knew how to work a dollar, but you can only save so many dollars when you work as a domestic, and her father was a self-employed plumber, well, plumbers might do pretty well, but nobody's out there creating a pension plan for him. Before Social Security, those people would have been at much more risk of poverty in old age, right?
Absolutely. In fact, before Social Security, poverty, I've done research locally here in Detroit, and the poverty rate among people age 65 and older was about 60% or higher. So most older people lived in poverty. Most working and middle-class people didn't make enough money during their lives to save for retirement, and there were very few private pension plans, and the public pension plans that existed at the state level were extremely meager. They paid $5 or $6 a month.
Before we really dive into FDR and Social Security, some states, as you mentioned, try to offer or require pension plans, but they were at first ruled unconstitutional. Do you know that legal history?
I know a little bit of the legal history, not much. I do know that many of the state, I think about half of the state pension plans, you couldn't even qualify for them until you were age 70 or older. And at the time, you know, few people lived that long.
And as I understand it, the courts ruled at first that requiring companies to offer pensions was a violation of the Constitution because it was the government getting in between a worker and an employer who had a private contract, and that wasn't the government's place. But
right.
Eventually the courts turned on that. I guess sensibilities in the country turned on that, and the courts found a way in the Constitution to allow the requirement for pensions.
Well, you know, to a certain extent, that change from the courts, from the Supreme Court in particular, was an act of self-preservation. There was an enormous amount of pressure from the Roosevelt administration, and there was an enormous amount of public outcry when they struck down these laws.
And, of course, some libertarians today would make that argument that the government has no place telling an employer to offer a pension.
We're revisiting these questions now of the proper role of the government that we thought were settled for the last 70 years. You're right.
And back to your oral histories of your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, their experience in retirement, if they even had that word compared to your own or what you hope yours to be. Gene in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. My grandmother was born in May 1864 while her father was serving in the Union Army. Now, come up to the 1940s, she lived with us, and we thought she was rich because she had a pension based on her father's service. I believe it was $27 a month. Now, to me, I went to work in 1937, and I worked until the early 1981-82. I'm living on my Social Security, but I do have a private pension based on my 43-year service with one company.
Would your mother, and that's some amazing history, or father or your grandparents, you knew that grandmother of yours, right?
Yes, surely. I knew her well.
Did she use the word retirement? Did she have that concept?
Never, never. She was going to work forever. She was a dressmaker, and I can still see her at her sewing machine in our bedroom.
Did she have an expectation? Do you think if she was alive today, she would have an expectation that she didn't have then of something?
You know, I think she was very comfortable, and we were very comfortable with having her. We would have kept her. I believe she died maybe 1949 or so, and we would have been happy to have her with us for many more years, and she would have been happy too.
Jean, thanks so much for calling in today. And Kate in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kate.
Yes. Hi, Brian.
Who do you want to talk about in your family?
Well, I'm from England, and my stepfather worked for the same company for 45 years. And then when he retired, he was earning about £28 a week. And he had expected the company to take care of him. It had been a family-owned business. But he never pushed to make sure that that was happening for himself. And so when he retired, they gave him a plastic alarm clock.
Oh boy.
And a check for £100. And it was basically,
oh boy,
there you go, Percival, thank you for your life. And so he relied on his, what we used to call in England, the old age pension. And it took him a couple of years to really get a little bitter about that. I think I saw that as a young person. I was in college. I was already restless and looking to get away, to change my life from what I saw around me. And I saw that, and I basically said, this is not going to happen to me.
So it affected your personal choices and your politics?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, I wasn't aware of it possibly at the time. But, you know, sometimes things happen to us, and then later we look back and we see, ah, yeah.
So what did you do to make sure that that wouldn't happen to you?
Well, I left England. I came to America, which I really loved.
Social insurance is better here?
No, it's just that I was able to kind of get into my ambition. I worked hard.
Uh-huh.
I produced television commercials for a living. I had an enjoyable career, and I was freelance. And the longest job I ever had in my life was 4 years.
Hmm.
My husband and I did certain things. We live in Brooklyn. We were able to buy the house that we live in. We have a tenant in this house that helped. That, you know, we used to rent out 2 floors. Now we only rent out 1 floor. And we also bought a building around the corner at a time when this part of Brooklyn downtown was considered, our friends were like, you're crazy. What are you thinking?
So seeing your stepfather go into poverty in his old age made you entrepreneurial and made you frugal?
Oh, definitely. I am a little frugal. But I wouldn't say he went into poverty in his old age.
Uh-huh.
He went into disappointment at his own self. He realized, you know, and it wasn't poverty, but...
And at his employer, who he thought after 45 years was going to provide for him more?
Yes, yes.
Kate, thank you so much. And Carla in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carla. Carly.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
It's Paula, not Carla.
Forgive me.
Hi. Well, my own grandparents never retired. They had 9 children who supported them through their old age, so they never had to retire from work. And hello?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. And my parents, my father owned a business and never saved for retirement, and then lived really poorly on Social Security, which was less than $1,000 at the time.
Did he talk to you about it? Did he feel that he made mistakes along his the way in his life, financial mistakes, or like the previous caller, that his companies didn't provide for him in a way he might have expected?
I don't remember him having those conversations. He was very... My parents didn't really talk about money, or they didn't express any regrets. I had to manage their money, which was really difficult. But it was a very good learning lesson for me, because I chose a very safe route in life. I became a teacher and worked for New York City for 34 years. And the pension in New York City is amazing. And now with Social Security, I'm 67. Between Social Security and my pension, I live very well.
And there's a lot of America that's angry at you for that, Carla, that what, a teacher can retire at 55 and live on a full pension for the rest of his or her life, however long that is? that maybe things have tipped too far the other way, particularly with respect to teachers and other civil servants.
That might be true, but it was a very safe route. I think people with my amount of education could have made more money during their working years mm-hmm. than I did, so right. I chose to make less but provide for my seniority.
Yes.
And I'm still working. I teach occasionally at a college, so I am still in the game, even though I retired at 55.
Right. And that's the classic civil servant's trade-off. So, Tom Jankowski, as we talk about the history of retirement in America, I'm thinking about the caller from the UK and some of the comparisons that she was making. So Otto von Bismarck in Germany was, in the global history of retirement, a big innovator who wound up influencing the United States, right?
Absolutely, yes.
When are we talking about this? That's like 1880s, something like that?
Yeah, late 1880s. 1888, I think, is when the German pension system was first instituted.
So like Social Security in this country, but a German version, something along the same lines?
Yes, very much so.
So we'll continue in a minute. More of the history. We've got some great FDR historical audio to play. Also, Frances Perkins, his labor secretary, who I think was the first ever female cabinet member in the United States. She was. And a big advocate of Social Security. And we have some tape of her in 1960, looking back on the roots of that. And more of your oral histories. Keep calling in with the stories of your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and what retirement, if they even had that word, was to them compared to for you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, 212-433-9692. Our family meeting on retirement continues. It's a family meeting on retirement on The Brian Lehrer Show today. We're beginning with some history and some oral history. People keep calling us with your retirement or your hope for retirement compared to your parents or grandparents or great-grandparents. Let's do some oral history. Go as far back in your family history as you can and tell us some stories of how they retired, if they even had that word. 212-433 WNYC. Still with us is Tom Jankowski, Associate Director of Research at the Institute on Gerontology at Wayne State University in Detroit, doing the history with us. And here is President Franklin Roosevelt as he signed the Social Security Act in 1935.
The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what would be their lot when they came to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long the job would last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 30 millions of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health. We can never insure 100% of the population against 100% of the hazards and vicissitudes of life, but we have tried to frame a law which will give some measure of protection to the average citizen and to his family against the loss of a job and against poverty-stricken old age. It seems to me that if the Senate and the House of Representatives in this long and arduous session had done nothing more than pass this security bill, Social Security Act, the session would be regarded as historic for all time.
FDR, enacting Social Security in 1935. Tom Jankowski, one thing that struck me in that clip was his phrase that Social Security payments could help prevent illness. And we discussed how social insurance was originally for people who were already too sick or injured to work, and only those people were entitled. And later we came to think of retirement as a time where you might be healthy and just have some leisure. But by the passage of Social Security, we hear that evolution in FDR's language, it seems to me, from an emergency response to illness and the poverty that illness causes to more of a quality of life argument. Is that a function of the industrial era economy and lifestyles, the post-agrarian world really taking hold in politics?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, there's always some gerontologists have called a structural lag. It takes social institutions a while to catch up with changes. And so, you know, we began moving away from an agrarian society in the 1860s, and by the 1910s and 1920s, we were primarily an industrial society. But the institutions that were there to support people hadn't really been developed yet. So Social Security was the first big step in that direction.
And more of your calls with your retirement compared to your parents, your grandparents, reach as far back in your family histories as you can. Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hi. Hello. I want to talk about my grandfather, my mother's father, whose name was Moy Damascus Vansaw, and he was a Texas Cajun whose people came over from Louisiana immediately after the end of the Civil War, within a couple of months, Louisiana Cajuns. And the Texas Cajuns were loggers in the forests of East Texas until the oil field strikes began in the fields of East Texas in the teens. And in 1924, my grandfather began working for Humble Oil, which became Exxon as we know it today, but Humble Oil in Humble, Texas. And he worked in the oil fields from 1924 to 1959, 34 years, 11 months. When he retired, it's the only job he ever had. And when he retired with what translated into 80,000 shares of Exxon stock in 1994, which is nothing when you're talking about millions. But he had a pension, and he had enough to buy a little house for himself and my grandmother and a quarter acre of land that he truck farmed. And from 1959 until his death in 1971, he lived a very lovely life of leisure and tending the farm and hunting and fishing. And so there was this expectation. My grandmother was a homemaker, a housekeeper, always busy, but not it was barter and not being paid in cash. So the expectation in mid-century was that if you took care of the company would take care of you. And one more thing I need to say about this. The Exxon and companies like that, Humble Oil, they had camp towns, just like coal camps in Appalachia. They built up whole towns in Texas, like New London. They owned the stores, they built the schools, they built the hospitals, everything. And so everybody living in a town all worked for the company. And you might recall in New London in the mid-30s, there was this terrible school explosion that killed over 300 children, a natural gas explosion that killed over 300 children.
Yes.
And both my mother and uncle were in that school. My uncle was the only survivor in his classroom. But that was a product of labor, you know, being under the total care of a company.
And what's the moral of the story? Are you comparing it to today?
Well, yes, because then we had a set of expectations that we thought were set in concrete, an expectation of mutuality, mutual respect. These were people of great dignity and a sense of their own self-worth. And to have that translated into, if you're no more use, you're thrown away and you're on your own, is a radical contradiction that was not seen on the horizon. And for those of us who grew up born in mid-century now, we've seen this total transition. It's Alice through the looking glass, Alice down the rabbit hole. Everything has become inverted and twisted inside out.
Deborah, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate your eloquence on all of that. And here's a clip of FDR's labor secretary, Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet member, as we mentioned before. She was a big proponent of Social Security, and she looks back in this 1960 clip on the roots of the act.
What I want to say is this, that I suppose the roots, if you look at the beginnings of the idea that we ought to have something of this sort, that we ought to make a systematic, set up a systematic method of taking care of the material needs of the aged and dependent, the aged and sick, the aged and poor, and later the aged, who must, something must be wrong with them, or they wouldn't be aged, you know. I suppose the roots of it really spring from that deep well of charitableness which resides in the American people, and the efforts and the struggles of charity and charity workers and social workers to handle the problems of people who were growing old and had no means of support, or not adequate means of support, not able to afford to do this or that, sprang, I suppose, the mulling of ideas about social insurance for the aged. But those people who were doing it didn't even know that it was social insurance. They just kept thinking that something definite, something that people could look forward to, would be a great asset and a great assistance to them in their work. Even de Tocqueville, you know, in his memoirs of his visit to America, mentions what he thought was a very unique state of mind of the American people, that they were so honestly concerned about their poor, and that they did so much personally for them. It was not a social action. It was not a it was a personal action. It was not an organization. It was not a national action. It was not a state action. It was not government. It was a personal action. And he mentions this as being characteristic of the American people. They were so generous and so kind and so charitably disposed.
FDR's labor secretary, the legendary Francis Perkins, looking back in 1960 on the roots of Social Security, and Tom Jankowski, as we consider this history, one interesting thing to me in that was her emphasis at the end on the private sector impulse for charity, as de Tocqueville noticed. The opponents of Social Security always argued and still argue that charity should be a private function, not a government mandate. So why such a big proponent of government insurance as Francis Perkins bringing up that private sector impulse?
Well, I think she's right that that has always been a part, an important part of American culture. But what happened during the Great Depression is that there was such a massive and widespread economic collapse. Unemployment was so high, and the means that people had to, I mean, they couldn't help themselves, and they had no means to help others. And in places like Detroit, where unemployment was 60%, the private charities were just overwhelmed. The resources were not there, and so social insurance, it became clear that social insurance was the only thing that could deal with such widespread poverty.
Was retirement at the corporate level ever a way of moving people out of the workforce to make space for others?
Oh, definitely. That was one of the driving forces behind the idea of retirement, and became one of the motivating ideas behind the Social Security Act, because unemployment among the young was so high. And so the goal was to move older workers out of the workforce and into retirement so that the next generation could begin taking their place.
So how much do you think that might become a motivating factor, either in corporate policies or in government policy, today? Because with the baby boom, we are moving increasingly toward a bubble of older workers.
Yeah, and not only that, but the problem with the baby boom generation is threefold. Number one, and I'm a member of the baby boom generation, we never learned to pinch a penny the way our parents and grandparents did. We were encouraged to, you know, run on credit, consumer credit, and number two, we're much more transitory. We don't stay in the same jobs. We don't stay in the same place. We move around. We're less grounded in that sense. We don't, you know, you hear these people calling in talking about how their grandparents worked in the same place for 45 years. My grandfather did the same thing. That just doesn't happen nowadays.
And at the same time that corporate America is trying to wriggle out of what once might have been seen their responsibility to provide a retirement pension.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I'm most concerned about is the move from defined benefit pensions to defined contribution pensions. Under the old system, the company managed the pension fund, the workers paid in, and when they retired, they got X number of dollars per month for the rest of their lives, no matter how long they lived. So the risk of outliving their pension was borne by the company. If they lived until a ripe old age, the company had to make up that difference. Now, with defined contribution pensions such as 401ks, the risk falls on the shoulders of the individual worker. If you don't contribute enough to your 401k, if you don't save enough money, and if you live longer than you expect, you're likely to run out of money at a certain point.
More oral history, going back as far as our listeners can go back in their families. Chris in Morris County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Both my grandfathers worked in coal mines, and both died long before they could retire. You know, jobs were much more dangerous then. And, you know, probably from their point of view, they both died before I knew either one of them. You know, suffering through poverty, you know, old age poverty would have been an improvement over, you know, their outcome.
So when you see what the coal mining industry calls President Obama's war on coal now for environmental purposes, knowing your family history, do you think, good, because that job killed my grandfathers, or do you think, gosh, people need those jobs, or neither?
No, I think it's good from an environmental point of view that there's no coal, but no one needs those jobs. Those were very dangerous jobs.
Thank you for your call. Sally in Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sally.
Hello there.
Tell us about your family.
I'm a 74-year-old retired person, and when my grandfather retired in the late 1940s, he had no Social Security, although he had been a teacher all of his life. So he and my grandmother, who was quite badly crippled, moved in with us, and my father hired him to work as a person who cleaned our house and worked in our yard so that in time he could earn enough Social Security to have a little pension of his own.
And what's the moral of the story? How different was that in terms of their choices or their expectations from what you might expect for yourself or your children's generation?
Well, our children are not yet at retirement age. My husband and I both have Social Security, and he has a very good pension from AARP because he worked in higher education administration most of his career, so that we kind of assumed that we would be comfortable at whatever level that might be. And I don't know what our children think with the conversations that are going on now about Social Security.
Thank you. Tamara, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tamara.
Good morning.
What do you want to tell us about your family?
We traced our family back into the 1720s. My paternal grandfather's parents moved from Lancaster, Pennsylvania around 1870 because it was getting too built up to Illinois, where they were farmers. And they both, my great-great-grandparents, lived to their 80s with family members. My grandfather went to the Naval Academy and was a Navy person and worked for RCA. So he had a very nice pension from both of those companies. My father was also in the military and then worked for a variety of military contractors and had a very nice pension and retired at the age of 74. And my mother also worked for the Department of Defense, and she just retired at the age of 74, too. But I don't see at the age of 50, because I've worked for a variety of different companies, that I'm going to have the same kind of lifestyle 24 years from now.
And so do you see a prospect of, I don't know if you have kids, but moving in with your kids? Because you referenced that going back up the chain.
Probably not, because I have kids that are going to be going through college shortly. So it's going to be a bit of a stretch for us because it's going to be, we don't have the same kind of lifestyle, and we don't have these retirement funds available to us, even with 401ks and Social Security, that are going to be going to hold us sufficiently, because I plan to be living to 100 years old, and it's going to be a very different story for my generation and probably my children.
That's a good plan, living to 100. Stick with it. Tamara, thank you very much for your call. So we're hearing this kind of parabola curve, Tom Jankowski, aren't we? Where people, if they go back far enough, they're talking about their ancestors who lived in poverty because there was no provision for retirement. Then you had a generation through much of the 20th century where a lot of people were provided for, especially if they worked for the same company for a long time, and now massive insecurity about retirement in terms of the current generations.
Yeah, I think that's an astute observation. We're kind of heading back and repeating history a bit. But one thing that we probably won't repeat is going back to an agrarian society with multi-generational households.
Although we heard that from the two last callers, was Social Security ever conceived of with autonomy in mind, that more older people could live on their own, wouldn't have to depend on their adult children, or for that matter, that the adult children wouldn't have to be saddled, if that's the right word, with their adult elders as dependents?
Absolutely. In fact, many state laws, I know it's the case in Michigan, and I'm almost certain in New York and New Jersey as well, that under state law, that adult children were bound by law to care for their elderly indigent parents. And in Michigan, if you had the means to care for an elderly parent and refused, you could be sentenced to a year at hard labor in prison. And so when I read accounts of people struggling with old age poverty in the Depression era, one of the things that's most commonly expressed by them is that they are terrified of becoming a burden on their children. They do not want to be a burden on their families.
So I think we now have the two callers waiting on the board with the oldest pension story of any that we've heard so far, or the oldest retirement story. So we have Anna in Tenafly and David in West Orange both joining us. Anna, you there?
Yes, I am.
David, you there?
Yes.
Anna, tell us about your family.
Well, I was prompted to call because of the comment about the Civil War pension, and I actually have a letter that I have a copy of a letter. And I'll just read you the very beginning of it. It says, State of Ohio, Jefferson County, on the 16th day of October, 1835, personally appeared before the Supreme Court of said county, Henry Van Tilburg. This is my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. A resident of said county, aged 90 years, on the 16th of February, 1836, who being first duly sworn, according to law, doth on this oath make the following declaration: in order to obtain the benefit of the Act of Congress passed June 7, 1832, that he entered the service of the United States with the following named officers and served herein as stated in the year 1775 or 1776, he does not recall particularly which, he was drafted into the militia, blah, blah, blah. So
this is a Revolutionary War pension?
This is a Revolutionary War.
Wow.
He claimed that he had the right to a pension according to some law passed prior to the Civil War in the 1830s.
But that means a law passed in the 1830s, that
Correct.
Long after the Revolutionary War, was the first to provide a pension for people before the Civil War. So that's interesting with respect to the timeline we were laying out before.
Yeah, it was passed on June 7th, 1832.
But they didn't get around to it until 55 years after the Revolutionary War.
Right, and he was denied because despite the fact that there's pages of everything he did, it needed to be 6 months' worth of service, and apparently they decided that it was less than that.
Huh. And David,
of course,
you have
this was like living in a farm here, living in a farm there, traveling here. You'd go home, they'd come back.
With the militia, yeah.
Right.
And David in West Orange, you have a similar story?
Yeah, it's very interesting to compare these two stories. My ancestor, Hosiah Brandon, fought in the Revolution as a teenager and then applied for a pension, probably based on the same act that your previous caller was talking about. He applied for a pension from the War Department when he was an old man, and he was refused on the grounds that he fought for both sides.
Wow.
But he appealed, and it turned out the story was his father was a Tory, and his father compelled him to go with him to join the Tory militia. And they fought for the British as members of the colonial militia, And then in the fighting, his father was killed, and Hosiah was captured. His mother went to the prison camp where he was being kept and persuaded the superintendent to let her boy come home. Anyway, as soon as he got home, he ran away again, and he joined the revolutionary forces. So, anyway, they finally did give him the pension when he showed that, I don't know.
They should have had the Mercenary Pension Act so you could fight for both sides and still collect. I'm just kidding.
But well, he never collected from the British government. Maybe I should try.
He was eligible for a Revolutionary War pension, in my opinion, just because his name was Hosiah. David, thank you very much. And Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, callers, for all your amazing pieces of oral history from your families about the changing notion of retirement and the changing economics of retirement, going all the way back, as we just heard, to the Revolutionary War, or at least post-Revolutionary War era for some of you. And we thank Tom Jankowski, from the Wayne State Institute of Gerontology in Detroit, for riding along with some of the American history of retirement. Tom, thank you very, very much.
It was my pleasure, Brian. Thank you.